Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today we're talking about a new type of electric motor that's more efficient and sustainable than what is widely used. Dan Lutis, our guest today. He's a professor of electrical engineering at UW-Madison. He's also the chief science officer and co-founder of C-Motive Technologies. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What questions you have about electric motors and the way they're made? Love to hear from you. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Dan Lutis, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So, sustainability. What's the connection between sustainability and the field of electrical engineering? Let's start with a small topic.
So, pretty much that's like one of the most vast topics there is, hence the chuckle. But in my particular case, electric motors are the thing that are near and dear to my heart, and they're an aspect of electrical engineering. And they account for about 46% of the electrical use on the grid today. So about ballpark number, about half of the electricity we use goes to spinning an electric motor of some kind.
Wow. And you're the co-founder of C-Motive Technologies, and I imagine that's part of what you're kind of working to do.
Correct. Yeah. So, I mean, in my case, you know, I wear multiple hats, both a university professor and a, you know, entrepreneur. And on the entrepreneurship side, we're really trying to take some of the innovations that myself and my co-founders and our engineers at the company, you know, are working on and try to put them to work, to use out in the world to do some good. And so for us, the sustainability play is both, you know, higher efficiency in the motor itself and also making them out of more sustainable materials and that are not, say, subject to volatile markets and things like that as well.
Oh, so if you come up with something that's good and sustainable at the right price.
Yeah.
The price, the economics is part. I think, in fact, you have four different levels of sustainability that are pillars that are on your website. I think one of them was economic.
It is. So, I mean, to be an inventor or a creator of a new kind of technology, it's not just the, ah, look, we did this thing and it works. It's done. It's not exactly, I wish it was that way, but not quite. So we have to consider, you know, does this work? Can we make it out of materials that are readily sourceable? Does it rely on international supply chain? You know, what kind of value does it add to, say, a customer that wants to use the machine? Is it going to be lower cost to operate? All these sorts of questions factor into a much bigger problem than simply pure science or pure engineering.
Another one of those pillars was social sustainability. Mm-hmm. And talk about that a little bit.
Well, that one, I mean, that can be a little more complicated, but my take on it is that, you know, like the Wisconsin idea is this thing that we tout on our campus. And for me and my co-founder, Justin Reed, and the other people at C-Motive, there's this aspect of trying to do, you know, more with less. And so both from a perspective of creating a new type of, you know, machinery that can, say, be made out of recyclable materials.
Mm-hmm.
So we like to joke, or I like to joke, that we could dredge up the Pacific garbage patch and melt it down into infrastructure. The reason we joke about these things is because the motor, the machine that we've created, is a machine that isn't made out of the three basic elements that have been used for the last, you know, nearly two centuries, which are copper, steel, and then in the last 50 years or so, permanent magnets, and in the last 20, 30 years, these so-called rare earth permanent magnets. And so they are made out of, you know, relatively exotic, although they're ubiquitous materials. They're very difficult to extract and refine and bring into use. And so those are called rare earth elements for that reason. But the machine that we've created can be made out of things like aluminum, plastic, ceramics, things like this. And it doesn't have all of the metal intensity that conventional motors have.
And so you're getting rid of, you're solving one problem, perhaps, in that the rare earth metals, mining them, or just they're rare. Mm-hmm. Okay, so how do you get around that?
So what we had to do was we went back to the drawing board of, you know, how a motor physically operates. And so I'm sure most folks...
How does one operate?
Yeah. Most folks, you know, when you're a kid, you might have taken a piece of wire and wrapped it around a nail and touched it to a battery and picked up some paper clips. That's like mm-hmm. a very classical electromagnetism experiment. Or, you know, that kind of experiment, that wire around the nail, that is the fundamental force that makes motors work. That experiment or the force that's holding your kid's homework onto the fridge, that's electromagnetism. And so what we use is we use electrostatics instead, static cling. So instead of using that force that holds your kid's homework on the fridge, we're using the force that holds your clothes together when you pull them out of the dryer. So that static cling, static charge, is what we're wielding.
That's really cool. We have a caller. Mike in Franklin has something for us. Let's go there. We'll come back to static cling in a minute here. Mike, what's on your mind? Thanks for calling.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for taking my call. I happen to be visiting a friend in one of the small neighborhood lakes around here, and the homeowners association around the lake has made it a priority where anybody that's going to be having anything on the lake has to have an electric motor on it. And, of course, with it being a small lake, it's going to be that. But I'm just wondering if knowing the different sizes of recreational vehicles that go on lakes, whether it's somebody just puttering around in a pontoon boat or somebody that is going to be pulling, a number of skiers, are some of the technologies that are being built appropriate for water recreation vehicles that would also, you know, reduce the amount of pollutants that are going in the lake?
Thanks for the question. So this is a broader question that is almost, you know, sort of motor agnostic. This question comes down to is really sort of the profile of use, as you astutely pointed out. You could have a little pontoon boat with a trolling motor and a few batteries in it, or if you want to pull skiers, you're going to need something more intense. So these sorts of machine are, you know, electric boats, ski boats, recreational craft are being electrified. That is something that companies are working on, and it's a little bit more difficult problem than, say, the electric car. The reason is, in an electric car, you can get in, you accelerate, you step on the throttle, you go up to speed, and then you can coast there. So you use all your power and acceleration rather than just sort of cruising. In a boat, you have to throttle up, achieve planing speed, and then you have to maintain that power to keep the boat going forward. There's a lot more drag, whereas a car can coast, a boat cannot, or at least nowhere near as well. And so the stress on the motor and the battery pack in a boat, like pulling a skier, is more significant than that of a car because it's continuous, whereas a car, you might launch yourself up to 0 to 60 in 2-3 seconds in some fancy car, but you get to that speed and then you back off, whereas with the boat, you have to stay there. So that's the engineering challenge for watercraft. But that's really more comes down to a battery technology. Can you make an affordable battery that can be fitted in a boat in a watertight space that can be continuous power to, you know, pull skiers for hours on end? So that's a little bit different of a question. The motor technology is there. That one is, at least in my opinion, more of a battery issue.
So the batteries, yeah, I could see that. And then also having a battery that can charge up pretty quickly, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, if you're out there for a few hours, but you want to go back out, you want the batteries to be able to be charged in a pretty quick hurry. Yeah, so it's a battery issue there. Mike, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Let's go back to the electrostatic motors. You were talking about static cling, and I'm trying to think about how, well, talk more about electrostatic motors and how they work.
Yeah, sure. So, the simplest way to say it is it's really not much different than the dryer example that I gave. And except the very first, let's do a little bit of history here. So, back in around 1750 or so, Ben Franklin made actually the first electric motor. It was an electrostatic motor. He had an old spinning wheel with thimbles on the end of it and these things called Leyden jars. And he would sit there and he would rub some rabbit's fur on it and he would get it to spin. And, you know, he was the toast of the town for being able to do something like this, using electricity to create motion. It was a novelty. It was a nice cocktail party trick. However, it didn't do any useful work at all. I mean, it doesn't really make sense. You can't run industrial machinery by rubbing rabbit's fur. So it was a novelty and you know, ultimately abandoned. And then, you know, about 75, 80 years later is when these other folks by the names of Faraday and Oersted and other people made the electromagnetic motor. And then, you know, people like Thomas Edison, Tesla, and Westinghouse commercialized it around 30, 40 years after them. So the electrostatic motor sat abandoned for a long time. And the reason that was because we didn't have the technology to make it work. So to make it work, you have to charge something up. And then as it moves, you then have to move the charge that's pulling it along. So imagine you pull your two clothes apart, right, after you took them out of that dryer. If you want to create steady motion, you drag one in front of the other, and then it wants to follow it.
Yeah.
And so we do that inside our motor. And so the trick for us, or one of the tricks that had to be solved ultimately, is how do you make a movable piece of charge go around inside something efficiently and effectively? And so we did that with a whole bunch of fancy electronics and clever engineering and things like this. And then also there's, I could sit here and talk for days on end on all the engineering aspects of it and down in the weeds, but the trick is that you need to be able to have one piece of charge follow another piece of charge, and then you move those around together.
Wow. Dan Lutis, our guest today, talking with him about this new electros, is not really new invention, but he's certainly got a great new twist on it. Energy Electrostatic Motors, and his company is C Motive Technologies. I have a website you could probably take a look at, C-Motive Technologies. Take a look at their website, and you probably see some great photos and so forth of what's going on with them. But questions for him right now as we talk electric motors and electrostatic motors, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Clara Neipert, our producer for this portion of the program, our on-air producer is Jill Nadeau, and our engineer, Trina LaSousa. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. A little later on in the show, we'll be visited by one of our weather guys. John Martin will be talking about heat and the heat waves that are going on around the world, especially in England and Spain and Portugal. We'll do that later. Right now, though, we're talking about electrostatic motors and electric motors with our guest, Dan Ludis, a professor of electrical engineering at UW-Madison, and he is also the chief science officer and co-founder of C-Motive Technologies. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Bill in Superior. Bill, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, thank you. See, I've been a mechanic in the automotive industry for a really long time, and, you know, everything's moving to electric, and we have all these new batteries and all this new technology. Why has nobody ever thought of, you know, hooking up an alternator to, or some type of generating system to the drivetrain of, say, a vehicle, these electric vehicles, so it can be charged while it's being used versus just relying on the charge that you get from when it's stationary? It seems pretty simple and stupid to me, but I don't know.
Bill, thanks for calling. Well, what do you think, Dan?
Well, that's a classic question, and one of the questions I often get asked, actually. So it's good to hear, Bill, that your brain's moving on this topic, because you're not alone. So this has to do with something called the conservation of energy. So the idea here of, say, putting a generator or alternator on, you know, picking up power as you go down the road. So let's say you got an electric car. You're going down the road, and let's say you have a little wheel or something that's making contact with either the drive shaft or the road. You can even go an old school bicycle generator if you want to. The trick here is that the power that's propelling the vehicle down the road is coming from the battery, and it's going to the motor and spinning the wheels, and you go down the road. And then that going down the road, if it were to spin this auxiliary generator you put on there, that's actually still the battery pushing the car, which is then pushing on your generator, which is then coming back. And so it actually doesn't give you a win, because the energy coming from that generator is being drawn out of the battery in the first place. It would be a great free lunch, but unfortunately the laws of nature don't allow it.
Yeah, and you'd have to have another battery. Would it even work if you had a second battery? You could be recharging a second battery. No,
afraid not.
It wouldn't work.
So all you can do is pour water from one bucket into another.
Oh, thanks for that question, Mark in Madison. We'll go to you. Hi, Mark.
Well, hi. This is a very interesting topic. I learned a little bit about this technology a couple of years ago, and it has a lot of remarkable features, which look very promising. But one of the, as I recall, one of the limitations on power is the dielectric constant between the rotating components and the stator and the rotor. And I'm not sure if the company moved to liquids. In that case, you'd want very low viscosity liquids. Perhaps the guest could talk about their progress in producing usable amounts of power within a size format that'll fit a lot of uses. Thank
you. Wow, this is a pretty deep technical question. So let me break it up into a couple parts, and then I can refer you to a spot to go to a deeper dive to satiate your technical sweet tooth. So in order to make all this work, so we don't have to do the Benjamin Franklin routine of rabbit fur, we have an interesting dielectric material that our machine is filled with. It has the, you know how magnetism picks up steel and paper clips and all that? So we fill our motor with a liquid that has that kind of property, but for static cling. And so that liquid is the thing that makes it go. And you can sort of think about it as like an insulating oil in a way, but it has additional properties. I won't get into that. But we did have to move. We moved to a liquid-filled machine. And so that machine exploits the static cling or charge properties and insulating properties of that liquid. I think that's the first part of your question. The second part of your question was, you know, is it going to be able to spin fast because it's filled with something? And the answer to that is we're actually targeting lower speed direct drive applications. So this is an application where traditional motors usually suffer. So motors don't like to spin slow. So if you think about if you have a cordless drill, the motor goes real fast and it goes through a gearbox to drive your drill bit. You think about your car. The motor spins real fast, goes through a gearbox to the rear wheels. So traditional electric machines all like to be geared down. The laws of nature favor them spinning quickly in order to be efficient. So that gear train that is normally used in all of these things is an efficiency law. So whether it might be like the drill or the car or a conveyor belt or a wind turbine or something like this, these gear trains introduce losses and reliability issues. And so we've sort of narrowed it down on the focus of our startup to be on what it's called low-speed direct drive application. So eliminating that gearbox, our motor naturally likes operating at slow speeds efficiently, whereas magnetic motors don't. So that's actually how we get around some of the speed loss or viscous drag loss of a liquid-filled motor, to your question, is that we're targeting applications where magnetic motors have substantial technical hurdles given all the gearing and all this stuff that has to go along with them to make them go slow.
So what would be the, give me some examples from from one extreme to the other, from the lowest to the highest level of motor that you would have use.
So like right now, because we're a small, you know, we're a small business. We're, you know, 20 people over in Middleton. And so we're not going to be able to go build a 5 or 10 megawatt wind turbine generator. That's just too big.
Yeah.
And so in our case, we're focusing to start with on more industrial scale sort of applications and say urban mobility. So these are motors that are a few horsepower and they're intended to go slow. So think of things like robot arms, conveyor belts, something like an urban mobility small vehicle, like a you know, like golf cart size thing. And so the one to five horsepower range is where we're entering. That's a huge market.
That's a huge market. It would have to be huge.
And the thing that's unique about us is that we don't have to use any kind of gears to go in between the motor and the load. And that is a big efficiency savings. So if you consider something like, a conveyor, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, that, you know, a gearbox might have an efficiency of, you know, 60 to 85%, something like that, depending on what kind of gearbox it is. If it's a fancy gearbox, it'll be higher. But, and so that's all of a sudden, let's say if you're in some warehouse somewhere and you're running your automation line or manufacturing line, that is power that you're no longer using. That's money in your pocket. That's also CO2 that's not going up in the air. So the value of electric machinery is often in its service life, in its use. And so there's two aspects of it. There's the motor, the physical thing that you paid for, and it's the embedded carbon and materials, and also sustainability of the thing.
Yeah.
And then also, if it's going to go sit in an application for 10 years, running 24/7, how much electricity does it save? And that how electricity saved is also translates into, you know, CO2 and all the rest of it.
To saved as well. Yeah. So, and these will run a long time from the sound of it, or could run a long time.
Yeah, the goal is to have great reliability and all that good stuff that, you know, is associated with a proven technology.
Wow. Mark, thank you very much for that question. Appreciate it very much. So the cost, you know, is there a big cost difference? I mean, does it cost a lot more to do put something like this together as opposed to a...
On a materials basis, no. So, I mean, we're looking at, so take, for example, a conventional electric motor.
Okay.
Is made out of a very high grade of steel called electrical steel that has very unique, well-defined electrical properties. Then you have copper, and copper's pricey. And then you have these things called rare earth magnets, which are extremely expensive. And so they're the thing, these magnets, we currently rely on them for all of our high performance motors. So that's those three things we don't really
don't
use.
Need.
We don't need them. So what we're doing, we have a tiny bit of copper, like a fraction of a percentage of a normal motor, just to make the connections for the thing. But we don't have the electrical steel, and we don't have these rare earth magnets.
And you can use, as you were saying earlier, ceramic or...
aluminum, plastic.
Yeah. Wow. Thanks for that question. Appreciate it very much. Brad in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Brad.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Just a random kind of question here, speaking of motors. I work as... I actually own my own pool company here. And I was just kind of curious, are there motors or anything that I guess you could say sit inside of a return or something like that to, I guess, recoup some of the lost power? I mean, if you're looking at, like, let's say 500-600 gallons to 1,000 gallons per hour flowing through, is there anything you can do to recoup some of the power and just use natural water flow to, say, power the exterior lights, things like that? I mean, I know it would be minuscule power, but with LEDs, I mean, is there anything that can be done in that regard?
So if I understand your... Let me sort of repeat this for myself to make sure I have a good feeling for it. So if you have a... If you're moving water around, pumping it around, looking to recover some of that kinetic energy of moving the water around to power auxiliary loads in your application, which is a pool.
Mm-hmm.
You could. However, it'd probably be, at least in my opinion, I don't know enough about your application, but the main thing here is that in any power conversion scenario, you want to minimize the number of times you do what's called a conversion change. Mm-hmm. So, because each time it costs you a little bit of efficiency each time. So in your case, if you have electricity to a motor that's driving a pump, you might as well use that same electrical source to power those other things as well, because it would have less conversion stages rather than trying to have a, you know, some sort of like little spinning wheel or turbine that picks up power off the water flow. Where you would want to use something like what I just mentioned, which is some sort of mechanical pickup of some kind, is if you don't already have access to electricity. But it sounds like you do. So
let me... How does the motor... does the motor need electricity? I try to imagine how this all works. Does the motor need electricity to get it going to begin with?
So... from the perspective of, you know, a motor, it's still a motor. However, its properties are different. So one of the ways that our electric motor is really efficient is that it doesn't have the losses associated with putting current through coils. So like if you in any, if you think of it, like, say, you run your drill or a hair dryer or a mixer, think of a motor application that you have in your home. After you run it for a while, you feel the side of it, and it's warm. It's hot.
Yeah.
And what causes that is the electric current flowing through all the copper coils inside that device, and that generates heat. Our machine, what it does is the electric currents don't have to flow through these highly lossy paths. And so, because we don't have these windings that the current constantly flows through, we don't have that kind of heat loss. And so that translates to less energy coming out of your wall socket to do the same amount of work because you're not heating something up. And so you're still pulling electricity out of the wall, but just because the machine's more efficient, not as much electricity.
Got it. All right. Brad, thank you again for calling. Jim in Cedarburg will give you a chance.
Well, thanks, Larry. And I'd like to ask what kind of application it might have residentially. Thinking about running our air conditioning and the AC compressor, would that be an application? And also running off of solar, would that have any application as well?
Okay.
Sure. Thanks for the question. So, so the residential market is not something we're immediately concerned with at the moment, since we are a small business. Got to pick some slice of the pie, not the whole thing. But, so HVAC systems or heating, ventilation, air conditioning are a potential end use, particularly in, say, large diameter fans. Say, like, you might, maybe not at the residential scale, but certainly at the commercial scale, where you have these big diameter fans that are on, say, cooling towers or on the tops of buildings. This is where things are large in diameter and spin slowly. So pretty much the criteria for us at the moment are you going a couple hundred, 200-300 RPM or less, and you want an efficiency gain? And so for that purpose, say a residential unit of some kind is typically smaller in diameter and spins faster. It's not to say that you couldn't use it. If you have a really gigantic family room and you want a big ceiling fan, by all means. So, yeah. But the nature of the machine is it wants to be paired with things that are naturally moving slowly and want to move with a high degree of either precision or low loss. So maybe one day I see more and more robotics entering the world. And so robotics is another area where this machine would play. So where you have to position something and hold it there. It's, if you think arms and joints and legs and things, they don't move that fast. Well, they might move fast in our own context, but in the context of machinery, it's not that fast. And so there are also advantages to actuation, automation, robotics, things like that.
Yeah, interesting. Jim, thanks. Appreciate it. Jim and Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi. Well, it kind of comes from the fact that this weekend, of course, we had giant thunderstorms all over, and you've probably talked about this before, but I'm just wondering where we're at technologically and the cost of harnessing electric lightning strikes with, some giant capacitors or something like that. I would imagine the cost would be incredible, but the rewards would be so good. I just wonder where we are at with that, and also just throw in how's fusion doing.
So, all right. So, lightning strikes. There's actually very little energy in a lightning strike. The reason you get a spectacular show out of it is because it's a small amount of energy that's released in an even smaller amount of time. So it's like a little flash grenade of energy in that You know, so the whole idea of harnessing something like a lightning bolt, as appealing as it is, as much as we want to do a Back to the Future 88 miles an hour, get back home, the truth is that there's not much energy in a singular bolt of lightning. Also, most of the energy is dissipated in getting down to the ground.
Down into the ground, yeah.
So, not too much hope there. And then on the fusion front, I'm not an expert in fusion at all. So I would defer you to asking some of my colleagues in my department, like Dave Anderson. But there are a number of startups currently being funded by very well-known venture capitalist firms that are making some credible headway on various fusion projects.
And speaking of headway, let's talk about C-Motive Technologies. I mean, where are you in this process of?
Yeah, so right now, we've been around a few years now, and in this past year, we had our first public announcement of a strategic partnership with a company called Sona Comstar. They make parts for their a variety of industries, but they're notably a tier one automotive supplier. So we're in this ramp up phase now of getting away from the sort of the laboratory science towards the commercialization. That's what we're full on right now, is establishing partnerships with folks on, both for the applications that they're interested in using this motor for, but also with folks here in Wisconsin about, manufacturing aspects of this. Again, we're a small business, and so we're good at the science part, but we're also working on leveraging the relationships with established manufacturers here in the Midwest on how do we bring this technology into the world. So that's also a pretty exciting part of it.
Yeah. So you're looking down the road 5 years from now. What do you think you're going to be?
So we're hoping that we're going to have motors under test with customers within the next few quarters. So,
okay.
And then sky's the limit after that.
Well, Dan, this is fascinating stuff. I want to thank you so much. Well, you'll come back and be with us again, and we'll talk some more about this as time goes on.
Absolutely. Love to.
It's really fascinating. What's your website address?
It's c-motive.com.
C-motive.com is the place to go to learn some more about the company and about what it's doing, because there's some good explanations and so forth on the website. But he's done a great job today explaining it for us, and I appreciate it very much. Look forward to another visit. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Larry.
Dan Ludis, professor of electrical engineering at UW-Madison, also the chief science officer and co-founder of C-Motive Technologies. Great to have him with us, and we'll get him back, and we'll do this again down the road. Well, time to turn our attention now to weather. We're going to talk about last month we talked about high 90-degree temperatures here in Wisconsin, but there's been some real heat waves elsewhere. And we'll visit with our weather guy, John Martin, about that next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.